Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So something positive came out of today, at least. I look at the fact that the charges against the guy who had his knee in on the neck of Mr. Floyd, the one who killed him, his charges have been upgraded to second-degree murder, which means potentially a much longer sentence. And as we talked about the other day with Attorney Malone, who pointed out that how they had written the original complaint was very beneficial to him. This is righting that wrong. And we also now see the charges against the other three police officers are there as well, abating and aiding in the murder of Mr. Floyd. And look, at the end of this, these four should be tried, convicted, jailed, and maybe at some point we prevent people like that from being on the police force. Just kind of a thought. Anyway, this is a time, in my view, of having conversations that are difficult. The question is where do we go from here? No one can look at that video and say that it isn't wrong. I have found no one yet who says that what we saw was not wrong. The question is, how do we make sure that that doesn't happen again? And here to share some thoughts on maybe where we go from this moment forward, I've asked Devin Pandy to come talk with us. Devin is a congressional candidate down in Georgia's 9th Congressional District. He's one of the No Dem Left Behind crowd that we've had on the program for a number of times. Devin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you. Can you hear me well?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Great.
So this is one of these moments, Devin, where, you know, as a country, we're in chaos.
Yes, we are, and it's going to take a lot more than what we've done in the past to get out of this chaos. You know, in the past, we at least had leaders who wanted out of the chaos as well, and who were ready and willing to stand up for what is right, despite the political backlash that it may have.
Right.
We now have a leader at the top who is sacrificing the First Amendment in support of the Second Amendment and for photo ops, for publicity stunts, and it's one thing for an entertainer to do these things to get attention. It's a whole nother deal when it's the president of the most powerful country in the world.
But, you know, here's the thing, and I've said this a number of times, none of what we've seen so far out of Trump is unexpected. This is who Donald Trump is. This is who a large percent of this country wants in this moment. And look, the fact that there's still a percentage that thinks he's handling things right, they're okay with what he's doing.
Yes. And I see that in two ways. One is because some of those people, what he's doing doesn't affect in a negative way. And the others don't understand how it's negatively affecting them. So yes, he still has those people who hang on his every word and are still supporting him despite his obvious and exponential lack of ability.
No, I mean, this is not a job he should have ever held. And look, right before us, we see that he's incapable of even understanding the problem, let alone addressing it. But here's the thing, and I this is where my mindset goes. We've got to get beyond Donald Trump. We've got to get to the point to where no longer are we on polar opposite sides of this issue, that we begin to find common ground or somewhere in the middle. And I think I'm in an interesting position. As I've said a number of times in the program, I grew up a minority in a minority housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I now live in a neighborhood that is you know, overwhelmingly a white neighborhood on a really good street. My kids see police officers much differently than I saw them growing up. And I think there's a perception problem with white America that, you know, maybe we, our interactions with police are, hey, the cop handed out glow sticks on Halloween or let the kids play with the sirens. It was very different when I was a kid, and it's very different in poor areas. And I don't think people understand that as well as they should.
No, and for the most part, it's no fault of their own. You know, we can take anything ever, and, you know, look at the difference between how one person who has experienced that thing and how they perceive it and how someone who has never experienced that thing perceives it. And so this is one of those cases where, for the most part, you do have a difference in life experiences when it comes to dealing with the police or how the police deal with you. And yeah, it's an issue that yeah, it's in the spotlight now. You know, we have these cell phone cameras, and so it's caught on camera more often than it was before. But it's not new. It's not new. And most people, most black people, and maybe people like you who grew up in not so affluent areas can tell you this is nothing new. We are unfortunately used to this. It's what happened. And I think it's only because of the technology these days that we're able to get national and global attention on these things. Because to most people like me, who grew up like me, who look like me, this happens. And we don't expect anyone to do anything about it.
So my question is, because, you know, this is, again, another one of those things that I say that I don't think white America understands. And I don't think they have the ability to understand what that is like. Sure, we've all had run-ins with policemen. We've gotten pulled over and we've gotten a ticket. And maybe we, you know, got heated back and forth a little. But rarely do you ever see someone yanked out of their car and you know, and pummeled for no reason. Like in this case, you know, maybe, I don't know if the guy passed a fake 20 or not. That hasn't been established. But, you know, for something that simple, the man was executed on the street. I don't know that that's something that white American can comprehend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's difficult. And you know, it's easier to understand when you can empathize with something, when you've been through it. But I think that even though white America, you know, even though they can't empathize with it, it is still possible to sympathize with it. But before they can do that, they need to acknowledge that it's real, that it's not rare, and that it's not fair. That needs to happen before they'll ever be able to even try to comprehend the fear that riddles our bodies as soon as we see those blue lights behind us.
And that's the reason that, you know, I'm trying to, because look, you know, the subject of race is not in my wheelhouse. It's not where my lane is by any stretch of the imagination. But I think it now has to become all of our lands. I think it now has to become something that we have to figure out how we get around and we do talk about, so that maybe we can understand what it is to walk a couple of steps in your shoes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll tell you, it's not only, I know we used the term white America just now, and it's, I want to caveat that by saying that, thank God, there are so many more people who don't have to deal with these things that are actually willing to accept that it happened. Today, I organized a rally for unity in White County here in Georgia. We went to Freedom Park, and we had about 7 speakers, all from different faiths. And this is the first time that an imam gave a speech in White County. This is the one of the rare times that a person of Jewish faith I don't think he did Kaddish, but whatever he did, I'm not Jewish, so I don't know. But we had reverends and pastors and everyone came together, and we had the local sheriff's department there as well, and they spoke, and we all stood in unity, and we had almost 200 people in this park, hanging on to every word of these speakers, because we were all talking, we were saying different things and speaking the same language as far as needing to come together to unite. We made this purposely a peaceful, prayerful gathering, and it was amazingly beautiful.
No, and no one questions the fact that there are these kind of events happening right now. But sadly, the mainstream media has picked up on the rioters and looters, because if it bleeds, it leads, and we want chaos and conflict. And look, there's a lot of it going on in the nighttime. You know, during the day, we see these stories happening all across the country, where people are coming together and peacefully protesting and doing the kind of things that you're talking about. But sadly, the message has become, well, it's just all about stealing sneakers and T-shirts.
Yeah, exactly. You'll have 2,000-3,000 people marching, and all the cameras will turn to the 15 people that just broke the windows of the Duane Reade and are taking things out of there. And so you have that less than 1% of people that's getting most of the airtime because it's exciting.
Yeah.
And I think that that is very it's irresponsible.
No, I agree, but here's the thing. You know, as I've been saying here on the program, it's time for people like me to not talk so much, close my mouth, listen, open my eyes, listen, see what's going on, understand what people want, what the demands are, what moves us to the next phase. And one of the things that, a number of people are saying, we can't have looting and all of that. You need to make demands and move forward. You know, what are those demands? What are the demands? What do we need to be doing? How can we move this forward in a constructive way?
Yes, that's very good. And unfortunately, I don't have all those answers, but I can give you some. So one is, demilitarizing the police. That's very important. Also, having a police force that is involved in the community that they're serving. The only times you go out into the community is to patrol. That's the wrong answer. You should be in that community doing things so that you know the community and the community knows you. That breeds trust.
No, I think that's extremely important. And look, I think that's the experience for people in my world. Everyone knows the local cop. He's the guy who coaches the local little league team. I've coached cops kids before. They're just like anybody else. They just have a job, and it's where they live. They're part of the community. I don't ever remember that as a kid. I didn't see many policemen in my housing project. So how do you do that? How is it that you get policemen to live in these high poverty communities? Because they want to get out just like anybody else. What is there an answer to that?
That's a very good question. And unfortunately, that's one of those answers that I do not have right now. But it is necessary.
Because for me, the answer is, and you can bash on me if you want, as some folks have. I've always said, as a kid growing up, I didn't believe it was about black and white. I believed it was about green. I believed it was about economic power. And if you could just move out of these neighborhoods where the high concentration of bad things happened, things would get better. Sadly, over the years, that hasn't been true. But it still comes down to economics, though, Devin, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It definitely does. And that's one thing so this isn't only, it's not just about black and white. Although everything that we talk about will probably come back to that. But it's not just about black and white. The economy plays a huge part in the affluency of different neighborhoods. And so if you have people that live in an area where jobs are not available, or the schools don't have textbooks, then what can you expect these people to do? They are trying to feed their families and survive. And so I'm not excusing any type of crime. However, when that's all you have, or when that's all you think you have, then what else is there? And so we need to be able to bring that what else is there into these communities. We need to, education is huge. Being able to have, a job or even a career, give people the ability to take care of themselves, and they will. Yep. People keep talking about pulling yourselves up by your bootstraps, but when you don't even have boots, much less the straps, how are you supposed to do that?
Oh, excellent point. You know, I go back to, A. Philip Randolph was the head of the sleeping car porters union. And back when they were talking about, starting welfare programs and handout programs, he was dead set against it. He said, we need jobs. We need jobs programs. And I've always believed that was the answer. As a kid, my mother was on and off welfare a number of times when I was a kid. All she ever wanted was a job. And all anybody ever wanted was that ability to work, play by the rules, and get ahead. And we need to make sure that those avenues are open to everyone, and stop with, in my view, stop with welfare, give people jobs.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I see the need for welfare right now, but that's because of the type of system that we live in and live with.
Yeah.
Once we change those systems, that welfare will no longer be needed. And I'm going to tell you that people want to work. They want to earn their money. But when you have people want to work, they want to earn their money.
Sure, there's something therapeutic about it.
Exactly. And so, we have a lot of pride. People have pride. And but when you are discriminated against because the type of hair that you have, or because you have tattoos, or because of the way that you speak, or your lack of education, if you're going from job to job and you can't keep a job, and it's no fault of your own, or you can't find a job and it's no fault of your own, and now we're pouring money into the social programs instead of educational programs. What they should be, these social programs should be right alongside the main programs, the education programs, to hold people over, and maybe until they're finished with their education. I'm really spitballing here, because there are so many needs in so many different cities, and not one solution is going to fit every
no, there's
every
not
situation.
And, but it's always been my view that if corporations can't or won't create enough jobs for everyone to have gainful employment, the public sector has to come in and be the employer of last resort, to where every person who wants a job has a job that's going to be able to support them and their family. And that seems to me to be a policy that we could move forward on. We could take the money that we're spending and what people view as handout programs, and give people gainful employment to do things in our community that aren't being done. That I think we absolutely need to do. Last line of questioning I wanted to ask you, though, because you're someone who has decided that now is the time to throw your hat in the ring and run for political office. And I know we haven't talked about your campaign, and I hope people will check out your website, devinpandyforcongress.com. We'll get links out on how you can check that out. You're running in Georgia's 9th Congressional District. And, this is one of those moments where this passion, this frustration that we see in the streets, I'm hoping turns into electoral victories. That, because I wonder how many of the people who are in the streets actually voted in the last election, let alone the presidential. How many people voted for their local town supervisor or their local pathonitary? How many people bothered to get involved in the local politics that really has more to do about their daily lives than anything else?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I'm trying to do right now, is to educate everyone, but especially people who look like me, because people who look like me are told, at least when I was growing up, we were told, don't bother voting. It's not going to matter. I didn't really realize until well into adulthood that I could even run for anything. I was just always told and taught that that's not for you. And so what I'm trying to do right now, not only am I trying to win this race and give this district the representation that they deserve that they are not getting right now, but I also want to be an example for little boys and girls who look like me, or little boys and girls who grew up like me, because you don't have to look like me to grow up like me.
Right.
We have, you know, every race has a poor section. And so I want those people to know that this is possible. You can do this.
No, so, and that's the message, you know, right there. You know, yeah. Don't feel bad that you didn't know you could run for political office. I tell this all the time. It wasn't until I was about 15 that I realized college was a place that you went for education. Growing up where I did, the only people I ever saw go to college were really great athletes. And they were back really quickly because they couldn't stay in school. But I was 15 before I realized it.
Yeah, when I was growing up, going to college was, quote unquote, for nerds. Going to college was not cool. You know what was cool in my neighborhood when I was growing up? Going to jail. Going to jail was cool. Going to jail, being able to come out of jail and say, yeah, I was in jail. I did so-and-so amount of months or whatever. That was cool. How do we change that? Education. And not just education, but examples,
right.
Role models. We need role models who, you know, both who have been to jail and those who haven't, to show that, one, you don't need to go to jail to be cool. That is not cool. It is not where you want to go. And we need role models. We need good, strong, positive role models who are doing good things in their community, so that young people who would normally not get that exposure see that there are good people doing good things.
Yep. You got to live by example. And Devin, you're one of those folks out there doing it. I hope people will check your website, devinpandyforcongress.com. We'll get links out. Devin, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. I most certainly would love to have you come back and share some more with us.
Thank you, sir. Anytime.
Good stuff. Again, devinpandyforcongress.com. Make sure you check that out. You've got a couple of bucks. Throw it his way. These elections are expensive. Quick break. Right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.